I'm Laura Vinroot Poole of Capital, and this is What We Wore. Lauren Sherman is a career journalist who has reported on the fashion industry for the past 20 years. This episode shines a light on the complexity and nuances of the industry and the power of finding your niche. Where are you from?
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I wasn't born there. I was born in Michigan near Lansing or near Trent. I always forget, but we moved there. My mom grew up there and we moved there when I was about a year old, and we lived super close to the city. We were in one of those suburbs where your address is still Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And so I could take public buses, and I grew up going down to the South Side and to Oakland, the area around Pitt and Shadyside, and these cool little pockets of, there was the Carnegie Museum, which is called the Carnegie Museum, and the Andy Warhol Museum opened, I think, right before I was a teenager. And that was a huge, huge deal. Yeah. And so we would go down, that was on the North Side, and yeah, it was a fun place to grow up, and it was nice to be so close to these really big campuses and have that exposure. And I started taking the bus downtown, or if I was coming from South Hills Village Mall, the trolley or the tram or whatever it was, when I was like 13.
And it's a beautiful downtown.
It's really, really nice.
It's a very beautiful city with the water, and it's really unexpectedly pretty. I mean, the buildings are incredible from that Carnegie money and all you know, it's
totally
pretty spectacular.
Yeah, there's great museums. There was a great underground music scene. Not that I was participating in it, but there was. And it was a really good place to grow up. I think there's a thing there that people call the Mon Valley mentality, or my mom called it that. And it's really about coming from steel town mentality, and especially the South Hills where I grew up and the suburbs there, it can be a little limiting. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of friends who, I had a friend who, I think she got into GW, and her parents were like, no, you have to go to Penn State. It was just, it's really common sense stuff. Yeah. And I remember when I was in going to the guidance counselor saying I wanted to apply to all these colleges in Boston and New York. And he said, oh, you have to apply to, I forget what it was called, some local college, just as your safety school.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, there's a safety school in Boston that's my safety school. It's called Northeastern. I don't need to apply. But there is like a bit of that sort of limiting thing. And most of the people I went to high school with who wanted to do stuff other than work in the medical field don't live there anymore. But going back now, I appreciate it more. And having that access to the city itself at such a young age was really, really nice.
Well, so how did you get into fashion in Pittsburgh as a little person?
Well, it's funny because my parents actually were buyers at, so my mom did not go to college. She did a like trade school program for being an on-air radio personality.
Wow.
Which is so weird. It's so interesting that they were both, she was kind of interested in journalism and he wasn't, but they met in Columbus. My mom moved with her sister was going to art school in Columbus. And so she was like, I'll just move there with you. I have nothing else to do. I'm 19, or maybe, I guess she was a little in her mid 20s by then, but they moved to Columbus. My mom started working at this denim store called Levitation. And she was the women's denim buyer. Because as you know, back then, like every store had a buyer. It wasn't just independent stores like yours. Like every department store had its own buyer. And so he was the men's denim buyer.
Wow.
And she was the women's. And actually, I think they were a little older. I think he was 23 and she was 25 when they met. And she used to go to the trade shows in New York.
Yeah.
And they were just both really interested in fashion. Terrible, terrible match as human beings. But my dad told a story recently that he bought her this Bill Blass coat when maybe I wasn't even born yet, or I was born in 82. So like right around then. And he said it cost, they didn't have any money. And he's like, it cost like $400.
Damn.
But I had to get it for her. And I remember growing up just being very aware of brands. Like she wore Halston perfume and was really interested in Calvin Klein and Halston. And they would get all their sheets, their Ralph Lauren sheets at Marshall's. And you see photos of them. Like I remember my dad came to visit me when I was living in New York, and we went to have drinks at the Polo Bar, and it was when the Polo store next door was still open. And I took him to the Polo store and the Polo Bar, and it was like the best thing that ever happened to him. He was just like, he bought a polo shirt, and then we had drinks at the Polo Bar, and he was like, this is so amazing. They were just both really interested in it. And so from a very young age, I was really, really interested in fashion. And I remember what I wore on the first day of school in first grade. And
what was it?
It was I think it probably came from Penny's or Kids R Us or something like that. But it was this dress with a big cow on it.
Ooh.
Like an applique cow.
Yeah, yeah.
And my aunt bought it for me. And I remember going to see my other aunt in Columbus and going to Lazarus, which was one of these other department stores that got scooped up by Macy's at some point, and her taking me and buying me stuff. I remember my dad taking me to Kids Gap after my parents got divorced and buying me like this amazing outfit. And they were both just super interested in fashion and aesthetic. And my mom was really into movies, and I watched a lot of movies growing up. And that I think also really influenced my sense of design and my taste. And my mom let me watch Twin Peaks when it was on originally, which I think I was 8. She was like, this is the best show that's ever been on TV. You have to watch it. But when I look back, I mean, I had nightmares for 2 years, but when I look back on it, it did really inform my like sense of style and all of that. From a very young age, remember being interested in it, being thinking about colors, thinking about all that. And then at the same time, really young, became interested in writing and wanted to be, I love the Today Show or, you know, like Joan London. I wanted to be.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely is not where I landed, but I kept being interested in journalism. And then when I was probably 10, my mom was like, I really wanted to buy a fashion magazine. And she said, you can buy this magazine, Sassy, because it's a feminist magazine. And it was still when Jane Pratt was there.
Yeah.
And I remember one of the early issues, there was a pair of that I read. It was probably one of her last issues. There were a pair of mustard color Converse. Mm-hmm. And it like clicked for me that there was something more than what everyone I knew was wearing. I remember when I was 8 or 9, you know, it was popular, like Daisy Dukes. And I remember I wanted to, there's this amusement park in Pittsburgh called Kennywood that everybody has a Kennywood picnic day every school. And there was a year that everyone wore, it kind of reminds me of what's happening now where all these 10 and 11 year olds are using really expensive beauty products like Drunk Elephant and all that. But everyone was buying these Daisy Dukes, and my grandma bought me a pair of short shorts, and my mom was like, oh my God. But Sassy, I think it clicked that there was something more than what I was seeing in the suburbs of Pittsburgh, but that also this could be my job. And
this was an industry.
Yeah. And by high school, I was like, I want to be a fashion writer and go cover shows in Europe. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so you went to Emerson College.
Yes. Well, I was going to be a journalism major, but then this was the era I started in 2000. I graduated from high school in 2000. And this was an era when you could major in online journalism.
Really?
Which is just so hilarious. Yes. But I was going to be a journalism major, but they were really focused on broadcast. And by that point I was like, I'm not that articulate. I don't want to be on TV. I don't want to have to get my teeth fixed. Like, I'm not doing this. But what they had there was this weird thing called writing, literature, and publishing. So it was sort of like getting an English degree, but I was essentially majored in magazine writing. So wow. I took a lot of literature classes, but I mostly took like how to produce a magazine, nonfiction writing. And there were a lot of fiction writers too. But yeah, it was interesting. And then I minored in journalism and did like the ethics classes mm-hmm. and some just basic how to write a lead classes. Emerson and I haven't been back in a long time, but it was very much like a trade school. Like you start your major your freshman year. I tested out a math. I didn't have to take math. I think I took one really weird science class. It's one of those places where if you know what you want to do, great. They really encourage you to get internships super early and get going. If you're not sure what you want to do, it's probably not the right place for you. And so I had a bit of a freak out when I got there because, you know, I'm in these like nonfiction writing classes and there are all these kids who went to private schools are just really confident. And I was like, if they all want to do what I want to do, how am I going to do it with when there are, you know, millions of people like this? And so the first year for me was definitely hard, but, and I did have a moment where I thought about maybe I should become a costume designer. Because I do love TV and film and kind of immersing yourself in those worlds. And I worked at the college bookstore for a while, and the woman who ran it, her sister was the costume designer on Dawson's Creek.
Well, and, yeah, I lived in Wilmington at the time.
Yeah. And I was like, should I do that? But then I don't know. It just worked out and I ended up getting to do what I wanted to do.
So did you go straight to New York after Emerson?
No. So my senior year, I did study abroad in London through Boston University's study abroad program, because Emerson, all the Europe study abroad they have is that you can go live in a castle in the Netherlands. And I was like, I have to have a job. I did the BU program, worked at the Gap in London on South Kensington, which was cool. Super high street, which was really fun. And interned at this company called Quintessentially. Have you heard of this?
Yeah, I do. I remember it.
Yeah. So it was like this lifestyle concierge service, and it was for people, high net worth people. And it was run by Camilla Parker Bowles' nephew. And then his friend who actually used to be a film producer. And I interned there when I was studying abroad, and they were like, and they had a magazine and they had this concierge service, and they actually had a newsletter that they would send out to members. And so it was like, what are the best top teas in London, or, you know, just really silly stuff, where to get your Christmas baskets for this holiday season. And they wanted an editorial assistant, and I knew how to hard code HTML. Which sounds way fancier than it is, but it's just like simple coding because of this weird program I had done in high school. And they wanted someone who could do like a little graphic design, a little writing, a little copy editing, and then basically hard code this newsletter. And they said, do you want to move here when you graduate from college? We'll hold the position for you. So I moved to London right after school.
Wow.
Yeah. And lasted under 2 years. It was really, really hard. But I liked it. It was interesting and it was a good first step. And I've always just been really interested in why people spend money the way they do. And yeah. So that ended up being a smarter move for me than maybe going to New York and getting in the Condé Nast assistant pool or whatever. The first year I was okay, realized I really did want to do journalism and this wasn't journalism. And I needed to move back. And also it just was so expensive there. Like I made my first salary was £18,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And I worked at this like Australian underwear store on the weekends to make money. And, you know, I like to spend money. So it's not, you know, so I saved up a bit, moved back to New York, and then moved there at the end of 2005 and got the job at Forbes at the end of the year. And changed my life.
And tell me about that. The job at Forbes was fashion specific?
So it wasn't. It was like lifestyle. The first year I was there, The title was audience development. My title was assistant news editor or something, but it was really audience development. So at the time, the way the big publications got traffic was that they, you know, AOL, MSN, Yahoo, they were called portals. And that's where most people would like visit that homepage to start their day or whatever, because they had emails connected to those companies. And I would pitch our stories to AOL and MSN. I would change the headlines to make them more portal friendly. Right. And then I would go back to the editors and say, the portals would like us to write this like terrible story, like 10 hottest beaches in 2007 or whatever. But I made it really clear I wanted to be a writer or whatever. And they also were interested in me because I had international experience. And I was talking, like, I talked to every week, I had a call with MSN India to talk about which stories, Forbes stories would be great on. And it would send insane amount of traffic.
Yeah, I was going to say, Indian newspapers are so amazing. Oh, Hindustan Times is the best newspaper on earth.
Yeah. I feel like that they come up in search so much when I'm researching stuff. And then I wanted to be a fashion writer. I remember talking to the managing editor about it. And he was like, you should read this book by this woman, Terry Agin. She's the fashion reporter at the Journal. It's called The End of Fashion. He said, and it really did change my life, because if I hadn't read that, I was kind of like, I'm going to take this job at Forbes and try to get, I remember I interned at Nylon in the fashion closet. They were like, you can't do this. They're like, why? You have a job as a writer. And
exactly.
But yeah, so I started writing about fashion really quickly for them. And then I was there for 4 years and wrote a lot of fashion stuff, but also just lifestyle. So it was broader. They were very not into having beats at Forbes, They, especially at the magazine. I was on the website and then they merged, but at the magazine, no one had a beat, which it's complicated. So they were like, you can't just write about fashion. You have to write about this other stuff too. But I did start really early, and I got to go to Paris once for Fashion Week with them. And that was really amazing. And I'm really glad it happened, because I wrote stuff for the markets desk. I really did learn about how to read a 10K, how the stock market worked, all this stuff that I had just never given myself the permission in my mind to be interested in.
Right.
And I actually am really interested in following the money. And so it did change the trajectory of my career totally.
And was it clear very quickly that fashion was the part that you wanted to continue with? That was the thing that excited you?
I remember very early on, one of my early stories, the editor said to me, you have a lot of authority in your writing. And I just think, it's interesting. Every once in a while over the years, I've thought maybe I should just cover something else, because I'm a good reporter. I could cover anything. Mm-hmm. And I have that natural curiosity that you need. But the truth is, I just know so much more about clothes. And even at that age, I knew more than most people. And so it always was, I need to get to a point where I'm just covering this and not having to do these weird vacation stories or best places to eat at the bar or whatever.
My dad always says to me, like, how do you know? Like, how do you know about this, all this stuff? And I'm like, I honestly have no idea how I know. I just know. Like, I've just always known. It's always been fascinating to me. I've always been interested, and it's kind of all I do.
Well, you have that merchant instinct. And I think, like, not many people do or they don't foster that anymore. And there is that thing. I'm like putting my two fingers together. It's just this thing that the people who are successful in fashion have. And I think, I don't know if I was in your position, if I would have it, but I really recognize it. And that's why I feel like it would be a waste for me not to be writing about it.
Because a merchant is really different from fashion, right? A merchant is, what is a merchant?
There are so many descriptions, but to me, it's a picker. It's the person who knows what you're going to want before you want it.
Is that Tom Ford quote, put three things in front of me, I know which one will sell?
Exactly. That's exactly it. And he has it. And not many creative people do.
Yeah.
Or designers do. So the ones that do, I feel like, are better off in the long term.
it's not only the picking, it's actually the serving. It's the ability to serve the client. Maybe sounds silly, but it is, show them what they want before they know they want it. But there is a lot of service in that and kind of taking care of the client and taking them along with you. And
I don't want to get too wonky, but I'm very interested in the one-to-one experience in the service industry and why that's so potent, I guess is a good word, and why it's so effective. But that's a little dorky, but I do think...
No, it's not. I mean, I think it's funny because I've been doing this 25 years, so we would go to market and no offense, but you would see, the team from Saks with 15 people. And then, our team was two people and we're writing someone's name next to every single thing we write. And the department store people, they've never been on the floor, this is just such a totally different business. And they're saying, we've seen on the Excel spreadsheets that 4793 did really well, so we need to order that again in a different color. And we've seen that we sold pink really well, so we need to do more pink next season. And it's just like, that's not what this is. I guess it is what they do, but it's not what I do.
I went to a Barney's trunk show for Carvan when Guillaume Henry, or however you say his name, was the designer. And I covered it. It was when I was at Fashionista. And he did this little like peach tulip skirt. Mm-hmm. And I said, I would like to pre-order this because I love pre-ordering things because it feels like it's free. And then you get it and then you're like, oh, I owe all this money. I remember the buyer saying, oh, we didn't buy it in peach. We just bought it in black. And this was 2011. I mean, this is long before they really started to have trouble. But I thought, that's not a good idea.
Yeah.
Buy a few in the peach. I don't know what the minimum is. But if I wanted other people, I'm pretty basic, like other people are going to want it. And it has at the broader level become this game of math. And I think that's why it's not as profitable.
Yeah.
I think that one-to-one thing you do is much more profitable on an overall basis than scaling to a point that you don't know the people that you're buying for.
Yeah. So from Forbes, you went Fashionista, Lucky for a little while, and then Business of Fashion?
In between Lucky and Business of Fashion, I freelanced, but BOF was my first freelance thing. I gave Lucky like a month's notice and emailed every person I'd ever met to say I was going to be a free agent. And I messaged Imran, and I think he gave me the assignment. It was the first thing I published. I think I might have gotten it before I had actually left Lucky. And it was right around the time that he had raised some money. So they were really, he had hired, I think, six people, and he was really building it out. And so I started freelancing for them with a lot of frequency. And by, I think, 2.5 years in, it was the same time I was doing one of my other steady freelance gigs was writing show reviews for Style.com. Mm-hmm. And when Style.com folded and Nicole Phelps went to Vogue, she was like, you're more than welcome to come. And I was like, I actually really like writing about Vogue. I don't really want to contribute there. And at the same time, BOF was interested in me doing a bit more. So I went on a contract with them. And then within 6 months, I was full-time. And I was full-time there for 7 years.
I think it's interesting, the quintessentially and then Business of Fashion and then Puck. I mean, you are a serial startup person.
Yes.
And that strikes me as really brave.
It's interesting because I am very worried about like, where is the next paycheck coming from? Because I didn't grow up with a lot of money and it was always a concern, like, where are we going to make rent?
Yeah.
So I am very, very worried about that. But for some reason, I don't know. I think one thing is when you work for entrepreneurs, if you know how to pick them, it's not that there's more security, but it's just, I don't know. I just really prefer it. I like knowing the CEO and I like knowing the people who started it and understanding why they started it. And also quintessentially, I just wanted a chance to move to London, but with BOF and Puck in particular, I'm very interested in media business models because, like retail, most of them don't work anymore. And so what are models that, you know, can scale to a point of mass adoption, but that are also profitable and that put the right stuff at the center? And with BOF, I've always been like a trade geek and I love business writing. And I just thought that I think so many industries could use a refresh of the way their trades cover them. And I really believed in what Imran was doing. And same thing at Puck. Like I just really believe in, it's very much a one-to-one model, and the way that they've done it, I was a huge fan of it before I started. I subscribed right from the beginning, and that is what attracts me. But I would never go somewhere where I didn't think that the people running it were competent. That makes sense. I mean, Fashionista and Breaking Media is another one. I mean, that's been around forever. That I think, and I don't want to disparage them in any way. I love those guys, but I think that could have been a lot bigger than it is. And at some point I needed to leave. But I think, you know, when I left Lucky to freelance in particular, it made me realize that I'm always going to be able to make money. Like, I will always be able to figure it out.
Yeah.
I'm never going to have to worry about not being able to pay the mortgage or whatever. And so once I became more secure about that, taking risks with startups, it felt easier. And also, I don't know. I mean, it's a lot easier in some ways, but I don't like bureaucracy. I worked at Condé Nast for like a year and a half. I was just like, I can't believe that this is just like idiotic. Yeah. I mean, maybe if I had worked at a stronger brand, Lucky was already like Lucky launched 20 years too late. It was a cool idea. It was a really smart magazine, but by the time I got there, it was obvious that it had missed its chance at everything. I remember going in these meetings with people who'd worked there for 30 years, who were on the like subscription driving. And this is 2011. And they were like, we're not seeing anybody buy print magazine subscriptions from the website. And I was like, that's never going to happen. I hated it so much. I gained all this weight. Like, it was just like, I was so miserable. I had this insanely huge expense account, which I'm sure they thought was nothing, but for a startup person, and I just like would take my employees out for dinner every single night and get drunk. Like, it just was like, ugh, I hated it. I don't like feeling lost in a big sea of people. And so the startup world doesn't feel scary to me. It feels comforting in a way.
When you're at Business of Fashion, how did you know it was time to move on? Or was it just the opportunity of Puck?
It's hard. I could have stayed there for another 10 years probably, or for the rest of my career. But I just started to feel like I didn't really have a beat and everyone else did. And that was okay because I was the most senior writer and I was allowed and all this stuff. But then you can't really follow and chase stories when that's someone else's job. And so I had started to feel like a little bit like, what am I going to do? And it started to feel like I should really move into an editor position, and I didn't want to.
Right.
I'd done that on and off in my career, and it's not for me. But, you know, I could have stayed. I'm sure that we would have figured out a way to make it work. But I moved to LA in 2020 as well. Not on a whim necessarily. We had really wanted to leave New York, but I think that LA always seemed a little crazy because I cover so many European companies. But we did it during the pandemic. I got pregnant the month we moved here, all of that stuff. And afterwards, the year I had a very generous long maternity leave. And when I got back, I was there for another year, and I was working on this book I'm doing on Victoria's Secret. And, you know, I just started to feel like I got to figure something else out. Like, I had really thought I would stay for another year and a half and go freelance again. It felt like I'd been there. That would have been, I think, eight or nine years. And it just felt like I was ready to move on to something else. And, you know, there aren't a lot of journalism jobs that I'm interested in for the many reasons we've already talked about. A, I have like a very specific expertise. B, I don't really want to work in at a huge publication.
Yeah.
And I had been following Puck, really loved it, and had reached out to one of the writers that I knew there and just said, if you all are ever interested in doing fashion or retail, I just want to be in the conversation. And John, the editor, had simultaneously been asking people, because he was interested in it, who they should hire. And a lot of people mentioned me. And so it just happened really fast and easy. And every job has been better and better for me. And this feels like the perfect fit. But when I started at BOF, that felt like the perfect fit. Yeah. I'm really lucky. I mean, I think one of the reasons I have been so lucky is earlier in my career, I wasn't like, oh, I think a lot of people would not have taken that job at Forbes. They would have been like, I'm just going to wait and keep temping. I was temping at this speakers agency, Harry Walker. Shout out. They were really nice to me. But like, keep temping until I get the like Arc Digest assistant right. job or whatever. And I was, and so, but I was like, you know what, this is a good job and I'm actually going to get to write. So I might as well. And it changed the trajectory of my career. But yeah, I was just a huge fan of what Puck does, not only the writing and the journalism, but also the business model, I think, is really smart. And it just feels right. I really believe in them. And it's been, you know, it's the best. It's been 9 months. I'm still in the honeymoon phase. So call me in a year. We'll see. But for now, it's still really good.
At what point in your career did you feel like you had developed your own voice, forever or more recently?
You know, it's interesting because every publication you write for is different. And mm-hmm. So at BOF, the BOF voice is the voice. And right. with reason. And when I was freelancing, the thing you have to really learn how to do is write, just take yourself out of it entirely and write for the publication that you're writing for, like act like I basically would just put on a show of whichever publication I was writing for. And then I had a personal newsletter that I was mostly using to promote my other work that I would write on and off. I haven't done it since I started at Puck because I just haven't had the time. And I also like feel satisfied in that way. But the voice part, you know, I remember I interviewed for a job probably, I don't know, 5 years ago that I did not want, but I wanted to meet the editor because I really like him. And he was like, you're not very voicey and we're a very voicey publication. And I was like, yeah, I don't, maybe you're right. And I kind of just didn't think I was very voicey. And then with this job, I don't know.
I think
like,
you're super voicey.
Now I am, but yeah. Like, it just like clicked. I was like, oh, I just went for it and it worked. And I was like,
funny.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's just interesting because everybody wants everything. Everything is subjective and, you know, everybody wants something different. Everybody's subjective. And this is really the first place where I get to be a business reporter, but I also get to write like my silly self. Yeah. And people are responding to it really well. And there's nowhere else that I could do this. And that feels really, I just feel really lucky.
For me, actually, the last part, the things you're reading, the things you're thinking about,
yeah.
I almost like scrolled onto that first. I'm so excited about it.
Yeah.
Because there's so many things I've discovered through it and it's really genius.
I'm so glad. Thank you.
There was a quote that I found of yours that said, one of the reasons nobody talks about this industry outside the industry is because nobody talks about it honestly, talking about fashion. Why do you think that is?
Oh, there's so many reasons. I think the main reason, and this goes back to my time at Forbes, and no, I had a lot of really good editors there and a lot of really not good editors, but most publications are run by men. And this is an industry that obviously men participate in, but is predominantly the consumer is a woman. And it's different from CPG because that's actually more half and half, but I do think this fashion is thought of as a woman's hobby. Mm-hmm. And so it, for many, many years, was not taken seriously in any capacity. I think Terry is the big reason it is. And honestly, she's really the only actual business reporter. Now the Journal has someone who covers luxury exclusively in Europe. But before, it was always like, I'm the European correspondent. I also cover luxury. The Times has Lizzie and Vanessa, but they're on the styles desk and they file into business. Like, they don't have a fashion reporter on the business desk.
Yeah.
So that's the main, I think the biggest thing is that, you know, most newsrooms are run by guys. I remember when I worked at Forbes, they'd be like, I wanted to do a story. Tommy Hilfiger was owned by this private equity firm. And I said, they're doing really, really well. I went to interview him. I said, I think this is a big story. I remember this one managing editor. He's definitely retired, so it's fine. But he was like, Tommy Hilfiger has not been trendy since the 1990s. And I was like, what do you know? A year later, it was bought by PVH for like $3 billion. And I just sent him an email. I was at Fashionista with a link.
No.
And he never, I don't know if he responded, whatever, he was a dick, but I think that there was just also always like, well, if you get Ralph Lauren on the cover, we'll cover it. But this other stuff is not as important. And I think what I've been lucky in my career is that the industry consolidated essentially as soon as I started working in the mid 2000s. And so now it is a really big industry that has to be covered. But the problem with that is that the big conglomerates control all the advertising.
Right.
So even at the big general interest publications and papers, where they will take a critical eye to it occasionally, and like, they'll criticize a runway show, but criticizing the business, that is worse to these companies. And so I'm sure you've seen, there have been a lot of Bernard Arnault profiles about Succession recently, and they're very careful because it's just not worth it, I think, to a lot of these editorial teams to take a risk and push back a little bit the reality is, like, scrutinizing and interrogating these companies are only going to make them stronger. And so I think people just get nervous. And also, as post 2007, as magazines have become more reliant or more worried about losing advertising, they're less interesting. The kinds of people who are hired at these magazines are less interesting because cool people don't want to work at them anymore. And there are certainly a lot of great people. Even a lot of the great fashion journalists, they just don't, they want to talk about the pretty dresses. And I understand. And a lot of them are really good at that. But I just have to be better at talking about the harder stuff. And I like, you know, I really do love fashion. And I love the industry, but I think for it to be respected, I remember I interviewed Robbie Myers, the former editor-in-chief mm-hmm. of Elle once, and she talked about how she thinks about Elle and how it's covered much more honestly. Fashion's covered much more honestly in France because it is a main driver of their economy. And it is here too, but, you know, differently. But she said, you know, in France, they think of fashion as, they put it in the same categories as film and music, all of that stuff. It's another pillar of culture. And so you should approach it like that. You're going to try a new band. You're going to listen to a new band. You're going to see a new movie. You're going to try this new silhouette or this new mascara or whatever. And that is a part of how you live your life. And here it's seen as frivolous in our culture, or even though I'm full of contradictions, but we're such a culture of consumerism. But when you think about how people will kind of hem and haw over the cost of a pair of pants but they'll go to Costco and buy all, you know, 50 pounds worth of cottage cheese or whatever. I don't go to Costco. But my husband does, but I don't. But anyway, the point being that I think it's just, it really does come back to that being that it is a feminine pursuit in many ways. And so it is not, interrogated in the same way that a lot of other industries are. I do think that's changing, and I don't think it's like just me or anything. I think it's just going to have to, because I don't know, 5 of the richest, 20 richest people in the world come from fashion and beauty, or maybe even more than that. And so, and as we globalize, and it is going to have to be more important. But I do think it's just unfortunate, because I can see the lies in people's work. Because, you know, I talk to people after shows and they'll be like, oh, that was crap. And then they're posting about it.
Like, amazing.
And I'm like, just don't post.
What keeps you interested? What gets you excited to still work in it, to be a different voice?
I love anything that is driving culture. And I think fashion is almost post, but the last 20 years, it has really been, or the last 10, this center of pop culture and youth culture. And that is exciting to me. I just love transformation and change. And so some things stay the same, and that can be frustrating as a writer, where you're just like covering some of the online luxury implosions of the last year.
Oh my God.
It's like, I mean, I can't even imagine from your perspective, but like, I'm like, oh, I thought this one was going to work. I really thought it would. And it's like, no, it's never going to work. And so that is a little bit frustrating, because it's sort of like, in some ways, I'm telling the same story over and over again. But then in other ways, there's just always newness. And this next year, there's going to be so many designer changes and these big, big companies, which are totally fine in the grand scheme of things. But this is going to be a challenging year for them. They are sort of losing their grip on culture in some ways and gaining it in others. And, you know, LVMH is sponsoring the Olympics.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And it's crazy. And that is what makes me excited. And I still love shopping and love clothes.
One last really important question. What did you wear to prom in Pittsburgh?
Oh my God. I have a great answer. So I was really obsessed with Gwyneth Paltrow in high school, like her style.
Yeah.
And her generally, I still love her. She's the best.
Oh, yeah.
And she wore this Calvin Klein during the Shakespeare in Love run, because I graduated in 2000. So this would have been 98, 99. During the Shakespeare in Love run, she obviously wore the best looks ever. And she wore, I think for the Globe, some minor award show, she wore this Calvin Klein gunmetal gray taffeta skirt with a black twin set.
Ooh.
And I bought for junior prom, I got a gunmetal gray dress, and I just wore a black button-up cardigan over it as if it was that. I literally copied
that
it. And then
it's so chic.
It was good. It was good. And my date for junior prom was Brad McElrath, who became a designer. He went to SCAD. He is now a designer at Dick's Sporting Goods or something like that. He's the best. I love him. And then senior year, I also really wanted to copy the Ralph Lauren pink dress, but I ended up getting...
I hope it fit better.
I mean, I did not get... I actually didn't wear a dress. I wore... Actually, this outfit looked better on me and was really cool, but my hair looked terrible. But this was before when curly hair, like I didn't know how to straighten it, and I didn't know... And there were no hair products for curly haired people. Right. The world has changed so much, but... I subsequently straightened my hair for 10 years and it was really bad, but grateful for innovation. Anyway, I wore this laundry by Shelley Segal or Segal. Mm-hmm. I think it was like hot pink tulle skirt, but like not, maybe not tulle, like organza skirt that I got at this outlet store called Gabriel Brothers. I don't know if you all have them.
We don't have
it's like, do you have Value City?
No. Yeah.
It's like
they wouldn't have clothes there, do they? I don't know.
They do have a furniture one, but they did have clothes in Pittsburgh at the Value City by my house. But Gabriel Brothers is like bottom of the basement, but you'd be able to get like J. Crew catalog stuff there.
Cool.
It would be like my mom and grandma and I would go for a whole day to Gabriel Brothers, and we would have lunch somewhere, you know.
That's
it was
awesome.
A big thing. And then I wore like a hot pink knit tank with it. So it was actually like a
so
cool
good.
Cool outfit.
I'm gonna
that
be honest,
one was better.
These are probably the best the best prom dresses I've heard of.
Oh man.
In the 100 podcasts.
I mean, I didn't look great in them, but they were cool.
Really cool. Thank you, Lauren, so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
It was so fun, Laura. Thank you for having me.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drozda. Please follow us on Instagram at What We Wore Podcast for additional content and show updates. QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.